This is a podcast from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute that explores budget policies and issues affecting low and moderate income Americans.
Good morning. I'm Bob Greenstein. With me is Jim Horney, Vice President for Federal Fiscal Policy here at the Center. As you know, the federal government's on an unsustainable fiscal course with deficits and debt that it will grow mightily in current decades under current policy, in coming decades under current policies. As we and others have been saying for some time, policymakers will need to agree on a comprehensive bipartisan plan to address this problem. And as you know, in recent weeks, more lawmakers are expressing interest in that. We see the work of the Gang of Six in the Senate and the growing numbers of senators who have expressed support for this in concept, even if many of their statements remain exceedingly general and vague. So this is an important moment. It's a time when the President and Congress may be getting closer to seriously considering how to tackle this issue. That part's good. But we need to get it right. That is, they need to devise a comprehensive package that not only addresses the problem sufficiently, but does so in a way that is fair and more likely to be effective and sustainable over time. The Center on Budget believes strongly in fiscal responsibility, but we also believe that policy details matter greatly, that just getting a deficit reduction package, any package, isn't enough. What's in the package, its mix, and how it achieves its savings really matters. That's why we issued a major report this morning to provide a framework and some key principles for deficit reduction and why we scheduled this call. I'm going to outline what we regard as the essential deficit reduction goal and six key principles for a deficit reduction package, and then we'll go to your questions. First, the goal. As a number of bipartisan panels have recommended, policymakers should aim to stabilize the debt as a share of the economy so the debt doesn't rise relentlessly as a share of the economy. That would put us on a sustainable budget path. To achieve that goal, policymakers should aim to balance the primary budget, the budget other than interest payments on the debt, because as a rule of thumb, if the primary budget is balanced, the debt won't rise faster than the economy, and it will stabilize. And that means running total budget deficits, that is, deficits that count the interest payments, of no more than about 3% of GDP, because interest payments are projected to be about 3% of GDP in the years ahead. Now, policymakers should meet this goal in a reasonable period of time, but it's neither necessary nor wise to meet it in the next few years. Putting austerity measures into effect while the economy is still growing pretty slowly would slow the economy and cause the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs. So ideally, policymakers would enact legislation this year that then begins to take effect once the economy is stronger. So that's how we see the goal. Let me turn now to the six principles. Principle number one, craft a deficit reduction plan that is balanced and inclusive, affecting all parts of the budget, and with the savings split about 50-50 over time between program reductions and revenue increases. As my subsequent comments will make clear, deficit reduction may need to rely more heavily on revenue increases in the early years and more heavily on program savings, especially in healthcare, over the longer run. Revenue has to be part of this. Revenue increases have been important ingredients of almost all of the major deficit reduction packages of recent decades, including those enacted in 82, 84, 87, 90, and 93. And they're an essential part of the package for two reasons. First, unless revenues make a significant contribution, we won't be able to address the debt problem adequately, at least not unless we decimate Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and pretty much eviscerate a lot of the safety net. And second, because of that reality, policymakers who care a lot about those programs are not going to sign on to a deficit reduction package unless it contains a healthy revenue contribution. I would note that a significant part of that contribution can and should come from tax expenditures. Deductions, exemptions, exclusions, and preferential tax rates, most of which really constitute spending delivered through the tax code, lots of which really are subsidies, and which Alan Greenspan once referred to as, in his words, tax entitlements. In 2010, the tax code included over $1 trillion in tax expenditures that greatly exceeded the cost of Medicare and Medicaid combined and Social Security. Each of those were about $700 billion, and non-security discretionary programs, which were less than $600 billion. Martin Feldstein, who was chair of Ronald Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, wrote last summer that tax expenditures are the single largest source of wasteful and low-priority spending in the budget and should be the first place that policymakers go to restrain spending. Principle number two, do enact caps on funding for discretionary programs, but only in the context of an overall deficit reduction plan that includes savings in mandatory programs and increases in revenues. Here's the issue. If policymakers enact multi-year discretionary caps on their own, separate and apart from a larger context, it likely will make it harder to get to our goal of reducing the deficit enough to stabilize the debt. Why is that? Because if policymakers who oppose raising any revenue for deficit reduction can get multi-year discretionary caps on their own without those caps being part of a broader package that also raises revenues, they'll have much less incentive ever to agree to the larger package. The larger package will be much harder to ever get to fruition. Consider a little history. Suppose the discretionary caps included in the 1990 bipartisan deficit reduction package had been enacted on their own in 89. If that had occurred, the 90 package likely never would have been passed. President George H.W. Bush and the Republican congressional leaders of that time wouldn't have agreed to the tax increases in the 90 package if doing so hadn't gotten them the discretionary caps in return. And the Democratic congressional leaders wouldn't have agreed to cuts in Medicare and other entitlements without the accompanying revenue increases. It's also important that multi-year discretionary caps instituted as part of a larger package be set at levels that are reasonable and attainable. Such caps come with no specifics regarding the actual programmatic cuts to be made, and as a result, it can be tempting for policymakers to write austere caps that require very deep discretionary cuts into law to show large deficit reduction on paper. But history shows that doesn't work. In 1993, Congress enacted multi-year caps as part of a larger packages and set those caps at levels that produced substantial savings but were reasonable and achievable. The caps were adhered to. The savings materialized. But then in 97, policymakers wanted to show larger cuts on paper. They gave in to the temptation to writing very severe multi-year discretionary caps into law. And what happened? Subsequent Congresses on a bipartisan basis ignored those caps and blew through them. Also important in fashioning such caps is to make sure that savings in both non-security and security programs are included, as the Bull-Simpson proposal would do. As you know, that proposal called for roughly a 50-50 split in the discretionary area between security and non-security savings. Principle number three, recognize that while the largest spending contribution to deficit reduction over the long run must come from the slowing of healthcare costs system-wide, that policymakers can't reasonably get big savings from federal health care programs in the next 5 or 10 years, or for that matter, from Social Security either in the next 5 or 10 years. The health reform law includes most of the steps we know how to take now to reduce health expenditures or slow their growth without increasing the ranks of the uninsured and underinsured, sacrificing health care quality, or impeding access to care. For over 30 years, Medicare, Medicaid, and private sector health care costs all have grown at just about the same rate per beneficiary, which shouldn't be surprising, since they all use the same doctors, hospitals, and medical procedures. This is why health experts have counseled for some time that trying to hold Medicare and Medicaid to significantly lower rates of cost growth per beneficiary than private sector health care won't work. It just isn't sustainable over time. The Affordable Care Act contains an array of demos, pilots, and research to test and identify cost-saving reforms in health care delivery and payment systems that could produce substantial savings over time, but they'll take time to identify, test, and institute on a broad scale. As a result, there isn't a realistic prospect of large savings here between now and 2020. And while restoring long-term Social Security solvency also can make a contribution to deficit reduction, here, too, significant savings aren't going to be secured in the decade ahead. There's bipartisan agreement. The changes in Social Security benefits generally shouldn't affect people now over 55, and the changes in Social Security benefits and taxes should be phased in gradually over a considerable period of time. Now, this raises the question. If we need to stabilize the debt in the decade ahead to get deficits down to 3% of GDP, and we're not going to be able to get large Social Security and health care savings in that period, in the decade ahead, where does that leave us? What do we do? That brings us to principle number 4. Meet the goal of reducing deficits to 3% of GDP over the coming decade through a combination of letting all of the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts expire on schedule at the end of 2012, and securing reasonable savings in discretionary programs, entitlement savings that are achievable now, and curbing unproductive tax breaks. This conclusion finds support in data in the Congressional Budget Office's January Outlook Report. The CBO report shows that if we continue on the current policy path, that is, extending all the tax cuts, AMT relief, and relief from the special cuts in Medicare physician fees, then deficits will run close to 6% of GDP after the economy recovers, reaching 6.1% of GDP in 2021, with the debt at that point around 100% of GDP. But the data in the same CBO report also indicate that if policymakers simply let all the tax cuts, not just those for people over $250,000, expire on schedule at the end of 2012, or if they pay for any of those tax cuts they wish to extend, deficits would be cut nearly in half. The deficit would stand at 3.6% of GDP in 2021. In other words, by letting the Bush tax cuts expire, we could reduce deficits in this decade to about 3.5% of GDP. We could almost stabilize the debt through this one step. And then when you combine it with other measures bringing in the other parts of the budget, you would be there. The debt would be stabilized. This is why both Reagan Economics Chair Martin Feldstein and former OMB Director Peter Orszag have called for letting all of the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts expire on schedule at the end of 2012. Now, of course, I recognize that letting all of those tax cuts expire currently enjoys little political support. But it likely, it is likely to be the only way to stabilize the debt as a share of the economy over the coming decades without draconian cuts that the public wouldn't stand for. As that reality becomes clearer, the politics in this area could change. Principle number five. What not to do? Avoid misguided proposals such as those that would place a statutory cap on total annual federal spending or write a balanced budget requirement into the U.S. Constitution, either of which would diminish the government's ability to respond effectively to recessions and instead make recessions worse. Now, caps can and have been placed on discretionary spending. Capping total federal spending or mandatory spending is an entirely different proposition. Programs like unemployment insurance, food stamps, and Medicaid automatically expand when the economy weakens, and economists refer to those expansions as automatic stabilizers that help to limit the decline in purchasing power in a slumping economy and thereby reduce the depth and length of recessions and help keep faltering economies from tipping into recessions. Without the automatic stabilizers, recessions would be longer, deeper, and more frequent. Caps on total federal spending as a share of the economy and a constitutional balanced budget amendment would prevent the automatic stabilizers from working. I would also note that measures to cap total federal spending at 20 or 21% of GDP, some of which are floating around in Congress, are also really designed to serve a second function. They're designed to largely or entirely shield revenues, including tax expenditures, from making any significant contribution to deficit reduction by focusing solely on the expenditure side of the budget. Look, under Ronald Reagan, federal spending averaged 22% of GDP at a time when no baby boomers were retired and health care costs were more than one-third lower as a share of the economy than they are today. The plain fact is that in the face of the aging of the population and advances in medicine and rises in health care costs since the 1980s, there really is no way to hold total federal spending down at 20 or 21% of GDP below the Reagan levels without decimating major parts of the budget and cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid pretty severely over time. I'd also note that such proposals, a cap on spending, a balanced budget amendment, really are cop-outs. They contain no specific program or tax changes. They simply legislate caps on spending that would have such draconian effects over time that they'd probably be blown away at some point, just like the Graham-Rudman-Hollings deficit targets were. There really is no substitute for making the specific hard policy choices in programs and revenues rather than hiding behind budget process changes. Last but not least, principle number six. Avoid making the problems of poverty and inequality, both of which are higher in the U.S. than in most other Western nations, still worse. Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson made that a cardinal principle. They elevated the need to protect the disadvantaged and avoid increasing poverty and inequality as one of the core principles of their commission's work, and they've reiterated that principle in recent weeks. History shows this principle can be honored if there's a will to do so. The three major deficit reduction packages of the last two decades, the 1990, 93, and 97 packages, all adhered to the principle. In fact, all three of those packages reduced poverty even as they shrank deficits. This principle also was reflected in the design of the Graham-Rudman-Hollings Law, the Budget Enforcement Act of 1990, and last year's Pay-as-you-go Law. The United States remains the most affluent nation in the world, yet one with high levels of poverty and inequality. There's no good reason for deficit reduction to make those problems worse.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Read commentary from our experts at offthechartsblog.org. Find us on Twitter and Facebook, and create a My Center account at centeronbudget.org.